The first question I have for you is, you came out of college and spent some time playing in Canada those first few years, and from what I understand, you were actually tending bar for your brother in Minnesota when the AFL formed. Talk about the process you went through in becoming involved with the Patriots.
Well, I did 2 years military service in the Army. And I came back when I was discharged to Minneapolis. I had played at the University of Minnesota. At 4 years, we played because freshmen were eligible because of the Korean conflict. And you could play varsity football for 4 years, which the Big Ten did, and I guess all the other schools had done that. And so when I got out of the Army, I was in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and I was able to play a little football for the bases that would go around the country. You know, we'd go to Bowling Air Force Base, go to Texas, San Antonio, and playing for service ball, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And I played at quarterback. I came back out and went to Ten Bar. My brother's bar purchased the bar before, after I had gone in the Army. And also my good friend and great football player, Bob McNamara, became okay. partners with my brother. So when I came out, they gave me a job as a bartender until I could get going and seeing what direction I was going to be going in until then. So attending bar became something that was second nature to us, and that's the story of my tending a bar anyway.
Okay, and how did you go from there to becoming a Patriot?
Well, Lou Saban was chosen to be the coach of the Boston Patriots. I'm going to refer to Boston Patriots throughout my career because that's what it was.
Please do.
And when I was working one night at the bar, Bob McNamara, my pal, like I said, who was an All-American at Minnesota during the time I played, and he said, geez, there's some talk about a new league. And I said, hey, whoa, a new league? I said, yeah. At that time, I was playing flag football because I had invested my 2 years in Canada, and I had a tryout with Detroit, and they all just didn't work out. So the talk about the new league, and I said to myself, I says, I've had too many disappointments, haven't got what it got, or what is necessary, and so I didn't pay much attention to it. So then the things started warming up, and Saban had sent one of the assistant coaches to Minneapolis, and in doing so, they sent out invitations to the former players at Minnesota, and also players who were living in the Minnesota area. They got a letter to try to get to the Radisson Hotel on such and such a night in an attempt to look for potential of football players. And so we went over there, and I got to say that I got on the short end. Things went so fast, and I had a very brief talk with the coaches and the players that I had known. So I got his phone number, Lou Saban, and when they left, they went back to their respective places, And Lou Saban was coaching Northern Illinois, I think, the year before he got the Patriots job. And so I called him. I got his phone number from Bob McNamara, and I called him and I said, Lou, I said, I don't have a glamorous background as far as football is concerned, I says, but I said, I would like very much to have a tryout. And he asked me a few questions, and he says, just hold on, I'll get back to you. Well, I got to tell you, that was like a month to 6 weeks, hadn't heard from him. All of a sudden, one night, I was in my place, my apartment, and I heard the phone ring, and I picked it up, and Saban said, Capoletti? And I said, yes. Oh, Lou Saban, he said. I said, I wanted to talk. He says, listen, sending you a contract, a minimum contract, $7,500, and you got as good a chance as anybody to make this team. You hear? Bang. But he says, we'll make the preparations for you to get here when summertime comes, and we'll be bringing the players in and all that. And I was so excited with the phone. I dropped it and I picked it up. And so he says, you got it? And I says, yeah. I says, oh, wait to hear from you then. So I got the letter and the invitation, and I went along to Amherst, Massachusetts, which was the University of Massachusetts football. That's where we're going to train at their football field and the things that go around with it and the dormitories. You know, it's the old process of football pre-camp living. So I got in and I went down and went to Amherst along with a couple of pals that I knew. And so that's the story of how I got into the Patriots.
Okay. The Patriots were one of the handful of AFL teams that were not particularly well-funded, especially in the early days. What were some of your impressions of the team when you first arrived to training camp? And how did they compare to the Lions that you had seen in the NFL?
You're right. I experienced the Lions and knew what it was all about. And when I got to Amherst, it was, you know, a typical training camp. And I think after a while, things got maybe a little testy, but they were pretty much all supporting the 10 members who had a piece of the team. They all had their 10 members who had put up, I think it was 10, yeah. And they needed $250,000. So the 10 owners put up $25,000, and they got that started with the franchise. And, of course, then we went through our drills and practices and everything. And so they had everything covered as far as we were concerned. And so they were, as you put it, not very well funded.
Did it seem like a first-class organization when you first got there, or was it maybe a less professional feeling than the NFL teams that you'd seen?
Well, you know, I only had that one experience with the NFL, and certainly it was likened what I experienced there. And, you know, we just, we did the routine of two practices, and then at one time they got four practices in, had them shorter, two in the morning, two in the afternoon, when, you know, they were trying to pick out members that could be starting off the season and the team, so they wanted to see as much as they could as to what the players are going to respond to, and also what the players are going to offer them as far as their abilities and their skills. So with that, you know, things are pretty much the same. But it was, you know, when you got there and you ate early, and then some of the guys coming back from the dormitory were still in time to eat, and they had a list pinned up in the lobby of the dormitory.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the names up for them to come and see the coach when you see that your name is up. And so you could see when the guys were coming from the dormitory and you were going to the dormitory, you'd try to read their minds because they'd seen the list.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I'll tell you what, it was really something that I just forget some of these things. And now I'm remembering it. And everybody was, if you were reading the guys' faces and their, whatever they said verbally, you got an idea, oh, don't tell me I'm on that list. So you got into the lobby and you went up to the paper right away. And you just scanned real fast. And you went fast again. And this is when there was time to be making cuts. So that was an incident that took place.
All right. You know, a lot is said about Lou Saban and his time in the AFL, but most of it centers on his years with the Bills when they were champions in the mid-60s. What were your impressions of him as a coach of the Patriots?
Oh, I liked him a lot. And Lou Saban, he was a straight shooter. He was tough. He was rough. And, I mean, you had to see the toughness in him. And, you know, his coaching abilities were what they turned out to be, and they did turn out to be that Buffalo won two championships. So after he went over there, so I liked him because I think I got some encouragement from him that is maybe just a little special. And I was trying out as a first year. I said I'm going to try out because I had been a quarterback at the U only because the left halfback, which was my normal position in the single wing especially. And Coach Wes Fessler at the time asked if I would want to try quarterback because Paul Beal, All-American, was at left halfback. He says, I want to get you on the field. And we played two ways then. You know, it was
sure.
Offense and defense. So I played some defense, and I think impressed the coaches here when I told them that I'm going to be a defensive back and I'll also be a place kicker and a kickoff guy and a punter if you needed it.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, you got to make the team first. That's the response I got. You got to make the team at your position and then we'll find a kicker from there. And so that was the indoctrination we got and how it all came about, and it's—I don't know—is that what you're looking for?
Sure, sure. You know, you played essentially only defensive back your first year with the Patriots, and did pretty well at it. I think you picked off Tom Flores a few times in one game.
Every time I see him, I say, "Tommy." You're reading where you were going. That's like 40 years later, I'm telling him that. Because he does the radio, and I was doing the radio with the Patriots. He was with the Raiders.
Uh-huh.
So I used to jerk him around a little bit, yeah. Well, I intercepted three of his in one game.
Uh-huh.
And I had a feel for catching the ball, Todd. Uh-huh. It was in the single wing, the quarterback, you know, the ball snap, you shift to the right, you shift to the left, where you go from the tee. But a lot of it was shifting to the right. And the ball would be snapped right to the left half. and then, you know, he has to run behind his blocking. But then when he wants to pass, he runs off to the right or left in attempting to pass, but he's going to show run, tuck the ball under his arm, and have the opposition think he's running.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tight end would be the deep receiver on a angle out, and then the right halfback would be the medium guy out to the right, say. And then the quarterback would be short and on the inside the 5 yard line or something. So he has the 1, 2, 3. You know, these are basic things that don't exist anymore, but this is what he would do. And he would throw the ball a lot to the shallow guy, which was me. And I caught everything. And I didn't realize that, you know, this was a talent that I had. I thought I threw the ball well. I thought I ran, picked my slots well and all that. But, you know, I wasn't catching balls until I got there at Minnesota. And that's how I got started with the Patriots and being a receiver. And turned out to be a thing that I thought I had the skill to do, and scored touchdowns and consequently put up points on the board. So, but you're right. I started as a defensive back, and I got beat by from Denver, the very first game we played.
Lionel Taylor?
No. It was, I think he scored the first touchdown for Denver.
Al Carmichael?
That's it. He caught one, or he went by me. And I was, you know, maybe having difficulty in the coverages, but I was doing a good job, I know, at reading where the ball might be going. And then I had one other interception, so I had 4 interceptions of that game, I mean of that season.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
So, did you welcome that transition to offense? Was it something that that once you realized you could do it, you thought you might excel more than you would in the defensive side?
Oh yeah, the first year, you know, it was kind of shabby, and things were. Things that, you know, you just weren't sure of. And so I would stand behind the offensive huddle when they were running plays in practice. And Jimmy Colclaw had run about 3 or 4 go patterns. Mm-hmm. And he was coming back, and he was just logging it, you know. And there was that space in the huddle. He was slow getting back there. I jumped in that hole, and I heard the play. And I remember I said I was standing behind the huddle for quite a while and listening to plays. And so I went out, and I was a flanker at the time, and I ran the pattern that I knew that he was calling. Just practice, almost a skeleton drill.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, I did a little thing there and a little move and turned. I caught the ball, and I, you know, take it downfield, make it look like it's something that that you train for, to turn and go. So I got back to the huddle, and Mike Hollaback was the receiver's coach, and he said, hey, he says, I want you to stay out after practice. We want to maybe work you into a receiver. And I think there was some injuries that had taken place, and they were getting a little thin in that department. So I stayed out there and did whatever I had to do or did things I would do, and I was catching the ball and running. And not blazing speed, but enough speed, I thought I had for a kind of secure ball catcher. Okay. At the point, because that's the first thing you got to do. Mm-hmm. And what you gain after that is just bonuses. So I did that, and then we ended the season in Texas playing the Texans and then playing the Oilers. And that was the season over, and I drove back to Minnesota for the winter time. And before I left, the coach talked to almost, well, as they do, they give a little spiel to the former, to the players of that year. And they told me that I had to make the team next year as a receiver or else. You know, they just weren't sure about the kicking part because, once again, they're looking for players performing at their positions. Mm-hmm. So I understood that. And then the following year, I went back and I had my breakout year, 61.
Uh-huh. Okay. Tell me, Babe Parilli came to the Patriots, you know, a couple of years after the inaugural year. They came in a trade with the Raiders.
What's that again? That again, John? You're getting a little bit of an echo.
Okay. Babe Parilli came to the Patriots, you know, a few years after the inaugural season. And,
yeah, 61. Yeah. It was the second year.
Yeah. Talk about the how you guys began working together, and I mean, you were eventually kind of a 1-2 combination known as the Grand Opera. Talk about the influence that Babe had on your career, what you had on his, and the relationship that you two had.
Yeah, the PR guy tapped us as the Twin Opera, the Opera Twins, the Grand Opera Twins.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't sure about that, but we went out and played. Babe was very instrumental in whatever success I had, and I'm grateful to him and all that. Of course, you know, two Italians, we could chum up together too. And I tell him, make sure you're looking my way, Babe. We got together, but also he was a great holder for place kickers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had nice hands, he had long fingers, and his hand was held the ball just the way I wanted it, you know, once I kind of described it. And he would be crouched down on his knee, And he was a great holder as far as a great passer. And we worked together and clicked very well.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a pretty good read on, you know, how I was I was doing double moves. Because a lot of times your first move and your first fake, you know, you wouldn't bite on it. Well, then we started giving them another one. Of course, we had to have good protection by them, too. And I don't know that the pass rush was as important as it is today. And I don't know that there were that many pass rushers. You know, defensive line mm-hmm. was basically just stocking up things and keeping them at the line of scrimmage.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the way that that part turned out.
Okay. Let's jump forward to 1963. You played the Chargers twice during the regular season and lost by a combined 5 points. Then the championship game came around, and obviously results were very different. Talk about that game from a Patriots perspective, and what did the Chargers do to confuse you guys that they didn't maybe do in the regular season?
Well, let me see. So it's a 63 season.
Right.
And the 64 championship game.
Correct.
Yeah, it was January 5th.
Yes, it was.
1964. We had to play the Buffalo Bills in a playoff game.
Uh-huh.
And we won that game in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
It was 26-8. We then flew back to Boston. Now, this wasn't planned, that it was going to be a one-week break for the postseason playoff game, because they had it all set up that they were going to play that game on the 12/28. I'm not sure about this, which would be 63.
Okay.
And instead, we played the Buffalo Bills there in Buffalo. And we, oh, no question, celebrated, and we were sky high, flew into Boston, and a pretty good contingent of fans were at the airport when we came in, and it was like 7-8 o'clock, and then we had to get ready for the San Diego Chargers, which were really heavy-rated offense and defense, and I think they were good enough to beat the NFL in that year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an idea, not an idea, but I know a lot of people felt that way. But so be it. So we had to now get ready for San Diego, and it was going to do 1 week after our playoff game. And San Diego, we kept alluding to this after. Said, they had 2-3 weeks to get ready, but they said they didn't know who to get ready for. Mm-hmm. But they were getting ready for Sid Gilman, of course, I think, was a great coach. And I really liked him. He was from Minneapolis originally, and so I would talk to him every now and then, just very short, quick, hey, many, Minnesota. And so the championship game, we kind of, I don't know why, but we kind of used it as an excuse for that loss. They killed us. They killed us. And we thought that, well, getting just that 1 week ready for a team was difficult, and then go cross country, you know, that maybe the out that we have and our performance. But we were really not the team that we were during the season at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but that happens. It happens on a one-game basis. But they were just terrific, and we had nowhere to go. I mean, they had 26 points at the they had 10 points at the half. Did they? I'm not sure now.
No, they had more than 10 at the half. I'd have to look exactly, but they had more than 10.
Well, anyway, we lost 51-10.
Right.
So there was nothing to do but to get our daubers up and try to go on from there.
Mm-hmm.
but I guess that was, you know, when we look at the game, that was something that all told us that we were in line for big improvements, mm-hmm. even though we were able to win the Eastern Division.
Uh-huh.
So it was one of the few times that the Patriots were going to be in playoff games, but they've taken care of that now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, you were a league MVP in 1964. You were the first AFL player to score 1,000 points. Ended up as the all-time AFL scoring leader. You were a five-time All-Star, played flanker, defensive back, kicker. You returned punts and kicks. How is it that you're still overlooked by the Hall of Fame at this point?
Well, Todd, I've had a lot of people that mention that, and I thought that the AFL was snubbed for a while. You know, a lot of guys that were players, I mean, and real good players, and it wasn't the NFL Hall of Fame. It was the Football League
mm-hmm.
Hall of Fame. No, it was
the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
It should have been the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and it was the NFL Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, Todd, that 10 years after I retired, 1970 to 1980, I thought that if there was any a chance for me to get into the Hall of Fame, it would be within those 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen some lists where my name has been mentioned almost at the top of the list during some of those times that you get over the computer and printouts and stuff like that. But once that became over 10 years, and you know, and the fans and a lot of friends have just continued to say that, and I get you know that I get fan letter today.
Yeah, sure. I've sent you a few of them.
But I got to tell you, I get at least two a week. And I may be generous in that, or lack of generous in that.
Uh-huh.
I just get them. They come from all over.
Uh-huh.
And all they want is an autograph on a bubblegum card or something. But they all write, and they all write the same things. I mean, I got to tell you, I was just looking at one over here. Dear Mr. Capoletti, I wrote to say that I admire and respect you very much. I think you are one of the best players to have ever played professional football. You are my favorite player to have every player ever played for the Patriots. It's questionable now. It would be great if you could sign the envelope and the photograph for me.
Uh-huh.
Now, for another example, I have this short note, finds you and your family. I hope this short note finds you and your family all doing great. I grew up in the 70s, so I never had a chance to see you play. However, any true football fan knows what a great all-around player you were during the time in pro football. You are an outstanding receiver and the best kicker in all of the AFL. Sir, would you please autograph these photos for me? Thank you ever so much. And I tell you, I'm so humbled by that.
Yeah.
And we're talking about 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it blows me away.
That's
good. Blows me away.
That's good to hear. You know, there's there are a lot of AFL fans still out there.
Well, you know what? I agree. And, boy, I'll tell you, there were two guys who did not want to join the NFL. One was Al Davis, and the other one was Sonny Werbelin.
Uh-huh.
They say, well, what are we going to give them $100,000 for? You know, we got our own league. We just won two Super Bowls.
Uh-huh.
And, boy, do I wish, and that I have always hoped, that they would never make the merger.
Mm-hmm.
And just, we got a league now. We spent 10 years making it, and we should play it as our league, the American Football League.
Yeah.
And at that point, I just could never get over it, but so be it. You know, I mean, some of the weaker franchises in the AFL may want to jump to that right away. Hey, you know, we made a good bet on the team being a success in National Football League. They're going to be millionaires, and that's exactly what they are. Zillionaires.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, with talking about those current zillionaires and pro football today, your team has brought up a bit of controversy this year with the whole Deflategate situation. What are your thoughts about that?
There was one thing I wanted to mention to you. Oh, you know what else? Just going back to the AFL now, what's happening is the records are gradually not going to be done
mm-hmm.
after 1970. So the NFL pro football statistics and records will all start from 1970. And I'm afraid that's going to be it's going to hurt the AFL.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I guess I got to hope that they're, you know, they're at one time they had the All-American Football Conference.
Mm-hmm.
They had the National Football League. And the All-American Conference was pushed by the wayside, and I got to believe, of course, they weren't as structured as the AFL.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back to your question now with the Deflategate.
Yes.
Well, I got to tell you that I am into the time I played
mm-hmm.
and what that would mean. Exactly nothing. You know, the pounds of pressure, PIE or whatever it is, or PEI. And that is one thing. The other thing is, it's a rule
uh-huh.
that you have to have it, you know, you have to have it contained in between those two numbers, and that's it. And I think they kind of... they kind of lost sight of that. And then again, it might have been a problem to get all the balls all done in between, especially in the cold weather and in the warm weather. There's going to be two different readings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the game is bitterly cold, it's going to affect the ball. And they got them in the... And then the kicking, the PK kicking, when they brought that into the game, that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that I could see a little bit of the pressure of a football when you grab it, and you throw it, and you get the, if your confidence soars while you're squeezing it and following it and feeling it. That's one thing. That's an individual thing. And you can't have everybody liking the same thing. So that part's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have a hard time dealing with that, except for the fact that it's a rule, and the integrity of the rules and the NFL have to, you know, come together.
Uh-huh. Okay. One final question that's actually goes back to your college days. I was doing some research, you know, figuring out what I wanted to ask you, and a friend of mine said, why don't you ask him why his college team refused to kick field goals?
It was that way for the whole collegiate colleges weren't kicking field goals then.
Yeah.
That was in the 50s.
Yeah.
You see, what happened was there was the drop kicking art was still around in the 40s.
Okay.
And when it got to kicking extra points, that's extra points were very big in collegiate football,
mm-hmm.
because it could swing a lot of things. And then again, you know, the teams that can use the clock and everything and save time, that's all coming after. But nobody was kicking a whole lot in the NCAA football.
Okay.
And I actually asked Wes Fessler, and this is when I was in the junior in college, and I went up and we played Iowa, and I was playing defense, and then I came back on the bench or took a breather or what have you, and I walked up to Wes, and he's on the sidelines, dapper guy, you know. And great guy. And I said, Coach, he says, yeah. I says, if we don't make this third down, you want me to try a field goal? And he looked at me, and he turned around. He says, go sit down on the bench. I went and sat down on the bench, and they ran the third down play, and it was unsuccessful. And he turned around, and he looked at the bench. He says, Capoletti. I says, yeah, get in there and kick. So I went running out on the field, and he said, send so-and-so out. And, of course, you know, the 11 guys playing offense, they're playing all the time. 11 guys defense, they're playing most of the time. No substitutions, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And so I came running out on the field, and they're looking at me, what are you doing? And I says, we're going to kick a field goal. And they start laughing. And I says, wait a while. It's just like an extra point. You're not going to do anything different that you wouldn't do in an extra point.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, bang, boom, it went up. We go ahead 10-7.
Oh, good
stuff. And
start.
We win the game.
Excellent.
Against the Iowa Hawkeyes. Now, there's a team that was tough and rough.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
Every year, we went to play in where we played Iowa. Where is it? I forget where they play their games now. The city. But somebody went into the where the Minnesota. They had the Iowa end zone,
uh-huh.
and then on the other end zone, they had paint. Black and blue.
Mm-hmm.
They said, that's what the Minnesota Gophers are going to be. Black and blue. Or blue and black. You know, for the bruises.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, that you know, that wraps up my questions. Do you have anything that you would particularly like to mention that I didn't bring up?
Well, I got to think that some of my success circles around what my job was. You know, kicking extra points, kicking field goals, scoring touchdowns. I should be the highest scorer.
Uh-huh.
And the only other thing I would say is that I played every single game for 10 years. Or is it, 10 years that I... The AFL was in existence for 10 years, right?
Right.
10 seasons?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I played in every single game.
Yeah.
And two other guys did, too.
Uh-huh.
George Blanda and...
Jimmy Otto.
Jim Otto. Three of us. And you know what that means to me? This is proving my passion. I did not miss a game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all you could ever wish for when you're playing as a pro.
Yeah.
And playing in every single game. In other words, I never missed a single minute of my passion for the game. And that's what I really had. I got pictures when I was 6 years old and I got a football under my arm. And it looks like a basketball because that was in the 30s,
uh-huh.
Late 30s and the early 40s. And I had this ball tucked under my arm, and it was just something I had a true, true passion for the game of football. Loved it.
That's wonderful. Well,